This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Tracy K. Smith is the 22nd Poet Laureate of the United States, and she's with us today. After a triumphant inaugural reading last night, which had how many standing ovations, Tracy? Pretty cool, right? How about those standing ovations?
That was wonderful,
well,
yeah.
In behalf of public radio and Washington, D.C., we are thrilled to have you.
Oh, thank you.
And because you're America's poet, then you need to read an opening poem.
Okay.
And this is going to be from the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Life on Mars.
Song. I think of your hands all those years ago, learning to maneuver a pencil or struggling to fasten a coat. The hands you'd sit on in class, the nails you chewed absently, the clumsy authority with which they'd sail to the air when they knew you knew the answer. Mm-hmm. I think of them lying empty at night, of the fingers wrangling something from your nose or buried in the cave of your ear. All the things they did, cautiously, pointedly, obedient to the suddenest whim. Their shames, how they failed, what they won't forget year after year. Or now, resting on the wheel or the edge of your knee, I'm trying to decide what they feel when they wake up and discover my body is near. Before touch, pushing off the ledge of the easy quiet, dancing between us.
That is the voice of Tracy Kathleen Smith. And everybody's been wondering what the K is for, I had to do that. And she is our Poet Laureate of the United States of America. She is the author of this Pulitzer Prize winning book. She was born in Massachusetts, grew up in California, the youngest of five children. Her dad was an engineer at an Air Force base, and her mother was a teacher. She graduated from Harvard with a degree in English and Afro-American Studies, and her MFA is from Columbia University. She has two other books, which are The Body's Question and Duende. So we're going to hear all about this poet who's the professor at Princeton University, I think ahead of the creative writing department, and she is ours for this time. Tracy, the first thing I want to talk about is your memoir, because Ordinary Light was a masterwork of vulnerability and honesty. It started with the dying of your mother, and when I opened it, I wonder why she's doing this structurally, you know. Then I ended the book with the death of your mother, and I knew that that was the silver thread of your life.
Yeah. It was a choice I made after I was pretty far into the book. It took me a long time to write or even want to write the scene of her dying. And when I did, I realized this is the thing I've known about all along. This was my motivation for writing. Every time the idea of loss appeared earlier in my childhood, now, looking back, I know it was calling out to this major loss. And I felt like if I waited to reveal that to the reader until, like, the chronological order of the book, I was keeping something secret, and that didn't feel right. So I moved it to the beginning of the book as a way of saying, look, this is what's bringing me to the page here, and this is why I need to go back to the beginning.
Are you saying that all your life you were getting ready to lose her?
Well, I couldn't have been.
Right.
But memory looks for these through lines, you know? So now looking backward, I understand that everything that signaled loss to me when I was too young to understand what loss was now kind
it
of
came
like
out in the book.
Ricochets against this other thing that explained loss to me.
Explained loss to you. Well, you have created a woman who will never die. You've immortalized your mother. I love her.
She
decorum, style, righteousness.
Yeah.
She was like some, and cake recipes. We don't have time for your cornmeal and lemon cake, but I'm sure that came from her, right?
Well, yeah, I still have a lot of her cookbooks that I haven't even gotten through.
But just your life, She organized your life in such a way that was just so much you could depend on.
Yeah.
So I recommend this book, Ordinary Life. I believe it came out in 2015.
That's right.
Yeah. So this was after the Pulitzer Prize, and you spent from 2012 to 2015 writing this book?
I actually started that book a little earlier than that. Life on Mars was finished around 2009, because I was still pregnant with my daughter when that book was handed in. And the next project I started was the memoir.
So, how long did it take?
It was about 6 years. But to be honest, the first bits and pieces of that book I started 20 years ago and just didn't know how to finish them.
That's interesting.
So there are these kernels that brought me back to the page. I don't know how many of those passages ended up in the final version of the book, but that kernel was something I'd carried around with me.
Oh, you collected images all that time.
Yeah.
Ordinary Light, a memoir by Tracy K. Smith. But she's our poet today. She's America's poet, and here she is with another poem.
The Universe Original Motion Picture Soundtrack. The first track still almost swings. Hi-hat and snare, even a few bars of sax, the stratosphere will singe out soon enough. Synthesized strings, then something like cellophane breaking in as if snagged to a shoe. Crinkle and drag. White noise, black noise. What must be voices bob up, then drop, like metal shavings in molasses. So much for us. So much for the flags we bored into planets dry as chalk. For the tin cans we filled with fire and rode like cowboys into all we tried to tame. Listen. The dark we've only ever imagined, now audible, thrumming, marbled with static like gristly meat. A chorus of engines churns. Silence taunts. A dare. Everything that disappears, disappears as if returning somewhere.
Tracy Smith, what are you trying to figure out? What questions does that book raise that you are struggling with? I mean, we see there technology is in it and pop culture some places.
Mm-hmm.
Also, many personal poems. So you go outside, and the universe is quite a bit inside as well. When you were writing it, what were you trying to figure out? I mean, science seems so substantial, and humankind seems like the fiction.
Yeah, it's true. Well, a lot of the poems come from this, sense of ongoing anxiety about who we are as humans and what we do to each other. And so some of the first poems I wrote toward this book were poems that were kind of playing with the genre of science fiction as a way of saying, if we don't change the way we act, what will we be in X number of years? And that took me into, the tropes of science fiction and the notion of space and the future. But then my father became ill, and he ended up passing away rather unexpectedly, kind of quickly. And so loss came back to me. I was trying to say goodbye to him. Mm-hmm. His death kind of reactivated a lot of the feelings of grief that I had lived with or kind of buried after my mother died. And so I was struggling to figure out what I needed to believe about where the two of them had gone to. And so the language of science and this kind of private theology that pops up with God, God, God all over the book, or it. I was trying to reconcile these things. Like, okay, the God of the Old Testament seems smaller than what I need to entrust my parents to. How can the language of the future that we now live in help me to augment this structure of eternity? And so that's where those two things are coming together. That's what they're trying to do.
And in many poems, you talk about the body and the wonderment of the consciousness after the body. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of considerations about human form and our essence. And that's why it is really, that's why it won the Pulitzer Prize. I mean, it takes very, very serious questions that had no language And you found the language for those questions. So let us have another poem. We're talking to the Poet Laureate of the United States of America. That is going to be big for your T-shirt. That's going to be a big thing to put on your T-shirt. But I love it. She's a professor at Princeton University and the mom of three children and a married woman. And she's our poet.
Well, I'll read you the last section of a sequence called My God, It's Full of Stars. When my father worked on the Hubble telescope, he said they operated like surgeons, scrubbed and sheathed in papery green, the room a clean, cold, and bright white. He'd read Larry Niven at home and drink scotch on the rocks, his eyes exhausted and pink. These were the Reagan years, when we lived with our finger on the button and struggled to view our enemies as children. My father spent whole seasons bowing before the oracle eye, hungry for what it would find. His face lit up whenever anyone asked, and his arms would rise as if he were weightless, perfectly at ease in the never-ending night of space. On the ground, we tied postcards to balloons for peace. Prince Charles married Lady Di. Mm. Rock Hudson died. We learned new words for things. The decade changed. The first few pictures came back blurred, and I felt ashamed for all the cheerful engineers, my father and his tribe. The second time, the optics jibed. We saw to the edge of all there is. So brutal and alive, it seemed to comprehend us back.
If you hadn't been ashamed, that wouldn't have been as powerful an ending, because it really is about your relationship with your father. And he was your rock.
Yeah.
And when you were little, you saw him as a very large presence, and it gave you faith that the world was okay. I was a military wife for 25 years, a career wife. What do you think you benefited from being close in that environment? What were the benefits of that?
I think that my father had this really beautiful sense of order.
Mm.
He was a meticulous man, and he was also really incredibly loving and also really strict. And so we had this sense of safety, protection, indulgence, and expectation.
And as an adult, he even told you to go to your room.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was on the job. He wanted to instill the things in us that he believed were important. And of course, coming out of the segregated South, the sense of doing and being the best always was, you know, like, of supreme importance to him. And I think that having him as an example validated that perspective, because he was everything. He did and gave everything for and to us that made our lives what they were, which
and
was
comfortable.
Was happy.
And he gave you the sense of organization that is in your DNA, I'm sure. You might even have a little math thrown in there. So you have your mother who has made housekeeping an aesthetic, mm-hmm. an art, and then you have him who's a successful engineer. And I would say you had a happy childhood.
Yeah, I
mean,
did.
You were learning things about what was going on in the world. But you and Ted Kooser are the only two I've ever known who have had a child, the only poets anyway.
Aww.
So Life on Mars is taken from a David Bowie song.
Right, yeah.
And you know popular culture. Let's have another poem.
Okay.
This is Tracy Smith.
Don't you wonder sometimes? After dark, stars glisten like ice, and the distance they span hides something elemental. Not God, exactly. More like some thin-hipped, glittering Bowie being, a starman or cosmic ace, hovering, swaying, aching to make us see. And what would we do, you and I, if we could know for sure that someone was there squinting through the dust, saying nothing is lost, that everything lives on, waiting only to be wanted back badly enough? Would you go then, even for a few nights, into that other life where you and that first she loved, blind to the future once and happy? Would I put on my coat and return to the kitchen where my mother and father sit waiting, dinner keeping warm on the stove? Bowie will never die. Nothing will come for him in his sleep or charging through his veins. And he'll never grow old, just like the woman you lost, who will always be dark-haired and flesh-faced, running toward an electronic screen that clocks the minutes, the miles left to go. Just like the life in which I'm forever a child, looking out my window at the night sky, thinking, one day I'll touch the world with bare hands, even if it burns. He leaves no tracks, slips past quick as a cat. That's Bowie for you, the Pope of pop, coy as Christ, like a play within a play, he's trademarked twice. The hours plink past like water from a window AC. We sweat it out, teach ourselves to wait. Silently, lazily, collapse happens, but not for Bowie. He cocks his head, grins that wicked grin. Time never stops, but does it end? And how many lives before takeoff, before we find ourselves beyond ourselves, all glam glow, all twinkle and gold? The future isn't what it used to be. Even Bowie thirsts for something good and cold. Jets blink across the sky like migratory souls. Bowie is among us right here in New York City in a baseball cap and expensive jeans, ducking into a deli, flashing all those teeth at the doorman on his way back up. Or he's hailing a taxi on Lafayette as the sky clouds over at dusk. He's in no rush, doesn't feel the way you'd think he feels, doesn't strut or gloat, tells jokes. I've lived here all these years and never seen him. Like not knowing a comet from a shooting star. But I'll bet he burns bright, dragging a tail of white-hot matter the way some of us track tissue back from the toilet stall. He's got the whole world under his foot, and we are small alongside, though there are occasions when a man his size can meet your eyes for just a blip of time and send a thought like, shine, 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 straight to your mind. Bowie, I want to believe you, want to feel your will like the wind before rain, the kind everything simply obeys, swept up in that hypnotic dance, as if something with the power to do so had looked its way and said, go ahead.
I really love that one.
Thanks.
Because it is so, you're doing so many things there. It's not about celebrity. It's about image. And it's about how, you're always talking about what part of us remains. You know, what part of us is out there, even though our bodies are in over there, and how we go on. So I find it very interesting that you're always evaluating a state of being, whether it comes from human form to image. And look, celebrity is something you know something about. So your image is out there and they think, oh, Tracy is always beautiful and has a beautiful voice and she's just got everything. And your feet might hurt. You know, it's like the image and the real person. And you have idealized Bowie because we need that.
Yeah.
We need that. You say, go on. And I find that to be a very interesting poem.
Oh, thanks.
Let's have another one.
Okay. Sci-fi. There will be no edges, but curves. Clean lines pointing only forward. History, with its hard spine and dog-eared corners, will be replaced with nuance, just like the dinosaurs gave way to mounds and mounds of ice. Women will still be women, but the distinction will be empty. Sex, having outlived every threat, will gratify only the mind, which is where it will exist.
Hmm.
For kicks, we'll dance for ourselves before mirrors studded with golden bulbs. The oldest among us will recognize that glow, but the word sun will have been reassigned to a standard uranium neutralizing device found in households and nursing homes. And yes, we'll live to be much older, thanks to popular consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Weightless, unhinged, eons from even our own moon will drift in the haze of space, which will be, once and for all, scrutable and safe.
Another thing, you talk about things that are speculative and hypothetical and abstract, but you bring it home. And that, I want to go back to David mm-hmm. Bowie in a minute, because when you say, I've lived here all these years, so that you really bring that poem home to center in yourself. You don't take the landscape right away, but it's the way you ground yourself in it at some point, like a little knot in the middle of a bow, is what really works in your poetry. I really think people need to study that. And I'm sure you just didn't consciously say, I'm just going to stick myself in here.
Well, it's hard. I mean, it's hard not to. We are, I think many of us, writing from a sense of, you know, wondering like, okay, who am I? What do I belong to? What does it mean to be here in the world and struggle with all the stuff that I'm struggling with, that everybody's struggling with? And I feel like every poem that I write is a wish. It's a wish to cross some distance that would answer some of those questions. And in order to really enact that, even if it's just, you know, in language, I feel like you've got to map out something and then get yourself there and move around within it and feel as though you can react to it. So I'm always trying to, you know, like build a world in this poem, not because it's exciting to have images for, you know, a reader to notice, but because if I can construct something that I can even momentarily believe is real, I can explore it and gather something from it.
It wouldn't work otherwise. You can't fake that, I'll tell you. No, that is, that's the... I think it's a wish fulfilled. I would say your poems are wishes fulfilled. Mm. And have another one, please.
Save Your Machine. I spent 2 years not looking into the mirror in his office, talking instead into my hands or a pillow in my lap, glancing up occasionally to let out a laugh. Gradually, it felt like a date with a friend, which meant it was time to end. 2 years later, I saw him walking up J Street into the sun. No jacket, his face a little chapped from wind. He looked like an ordinary man carrying shirts home from the laundry, smiling about something his daughter had said earlier that morning. Back before you existed to me, you were a theory.
Hmm.
Now I know everything. The words you hate, where you itch at night. In our hallway, there are 5 photos of your dead wife. This is what we mean by sharing a life. Still, from time to time, I think of him watching me from over the top of his glasses or eating candy from a jar. I remember thanking him each time the session was done. But mostly, what I see is a human hand reaching down to lift a pebble from my tongue.
That knocked me out, that last line. And when you begin reading the poem, you think it's a love poem.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe it is, because of someone who gave you the gift of yourself. Do you feel that was fundamental, that therapy is fundamental to speech, to being, the insight is what
mm-hmm.
helps?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, poetry is a kind of therapy because you're working so many things out, but then there are other things that don't even seem to merit a poem. And therapists are great because they can allow you to speak of those things.
Did you work with a therapist through your memoir? Because that was hard,
no,
right?
No, I didn't. This poem is really, you know, inspired by a therapist that I had for several years.
But the pebble from the top.
And then
how did that ever occur to you?
I think it's from a folktale. I remember a folktale. I forget what it's called. Maybe it's called The Rooster.
Oh, that's
The Parrot.
Great.
It's
that's
an Italian
great.
Folktale where someone is, you know, made mute And then eventually she's saved because someone just says, oh, you have a pebble in your mouth. Let me take it out. Now you can speak.
See, we all need to read everything. There's I bet that was from your childhood. Now, this is Tracy Kathleen Smith, and we're rounding the bend. And so she has a new book coming out. It's called Wade in the Water. Who's producing that?
Grey Wolf.
Grey Wolf. They are rocking.
Yeah, they're my home.
They are the ones. I'm so glad to hear that. And would you give us a sample of that? Just a touch of that.
Sure. This is a poem called Ash. Strange house we must keep and fill. House that eats and pleads and kills. House on legs. House on fire. House infested with desire. Haunted house. Lonely house. House of trick and suck and shrug. Give it to me, house. I need you, baby, house. House whose rooms are pooled with blood. House with hands. House of guilt. House that other houses built. House of lies and pride and bone. House afraid to be alone. House like an engine that churns and stalls. House with skin and hair for walls. House the seasons singe and douse. House that believes it is not a house.
Tracy Smith, we haven't mentioned the powerful testimonies about race that you have in Life on Mars and in Wade in the Water. Right. And you read last night letters, literally letters from men in the Civil War.
Right. African-American soldiers in the Civil War and their families often wrote to President Abraham Lincoln asking for help, asking for pay, asking for information relevant to their own freedom. And it's a really compelling list of documents.
It is going to be amazing. How much of your book does that comprise?
That, I think of it as kind of a central poem, and it's quite long. Mm-hmm. It's probably maybe a 12-page poem that's exclusively found material. And I like the idea of looking backward to history in order to find something that's really useful and applicable to us now. And I feel like that poem speaks to a lot of things that we're still struggling with.
And unknown before, those men's voices.
Well,
you know, from silence.
Yeah, I mean, there's scholars that have done some really amazing work recovering this material, and that's what I relied on in writing the poem.
And I would like to say that there are testimonies of those victimized in Life on Mars, that you certainly make reference to people who should be remembered there. So you're an activist poet in that you're a historian, and you preserve those things that we're silent. Tracy K. Smith is the United States Poet Laureate. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional funding by Friends of Poetry, Hiram LaRue and Candace Katz. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.